Hello everyone, it's Friday the 31st of March and welcome to episode 148 of the Kite Podcast with me, Ben Eagle, and Mr. Will Evans. This week, John has been at the IFCN Ukulele Applet Workshop in Brussels discussing the huge issues impacting on dairy in the world right now and considering the short and the medium term outlook when it comes to the sector. Originally set up in 1959, Ukulele presents itself as the voice of the European dairy trading community and represents around 430 businesses across 21 countries, including the UK. We'll be talking about Ukulele and the outlook in the context of sustainability and how markets and sustainability might interact moving forwards. We'll also be talking about the markets today. We're joined today by Kite director John Allen, Kite's head of sustainability Hayley Campbell-Gibbons, our podcast producer and senior consultant at Kite Becky Leach, and as always, everybody's favourite dairy market analyst Chris Walkland. Chris, let's go over to you first of all for the milk market report. Where are you this week?
Well, I'm bringing you my report from the Twilight Zone, and spookily eerie it is too. It's a place in the dairy industry that few know and where even fewer dare to tread. There's perpetual moonlight here and dense fog engulfs all and never lifts. People, if that's what you can call them, wear black coats and hoods and you never see their faces. They don't so much walk around the place, but float. Because this is the land of the dairy traders. It's where John and Eric have been this week. Most who cross into the Twilight Zone get swallowed into the abyss. But by the skin of their teeth, John and Eric have escaped to live another day. And thankfully, John is here to tell the tale. But before then, my report. So has anything significant happened since last week? Well, let's start with milk prices. Friesland Campina dropped 5.75 euros this week to 44.75. That's a record price drop. Arla announced today it is down 5.1 pence on a standard litre to 38.08p for April, down 5.3 pence on a manufacturing basis. That takes April's overall non-aligned price to a fraction over 40 pence. At the time of recording this, I've not heard anything for May. I've rung around, but everybody seems to be waiting for everyone else and no one is answering the phones. But I am expecting several companies to go another 2 to 3 pence for May. And against those predicted drops, though, Tesco has increased its price by a penny to 43.5 pence. So if that's where the cost of production is, then, well, you do the maths between that and predicted milk prices for May. So to what degree should this be a surprise? Well, I don't think it should be a surprise at all. As far back as the 9th of December, I ran my numbers and they predicted May's non-aligned average would be 39 pence and June's 38p. By January, the prospects had dropped a further to 38 pence for May and 37 pence for June. So around 4 months back, I think my figures are 1 pence and a month out. So as I said, they shouldn't come as much of a surprise. So are the prospects getting any better? Well, alas, not. The GDT pulse auction for whole milk powder fell again this week, and there's not much optimism for next week's auction either. New Zealand futures prices keep sliding. Whole milk prices are lower on the futures than the last auction, so that doesn't bode well for a positive result next week. In the EU, German and Dutch butter have dropped again to 4,700 euros, supposedly, but that's still way higher than some of the spot prices I hear. at around 4,450 to 4,500 euros, and Eastern European butter is significantly cheaper than that. Skim powder is lower too, in the 2,350 euro, 2,400 range. And to put butter and skim in context, they convert to, well, about 28 pence on a milk price basis. I'll have you know, the official prices from Germany and Dutch are around 30 pence. But as I said earlier, that's over cooking matters. Cream prices, though, here are pretty stable, about £1.55 to £1.60 for export. That's per kilo, so no significant change there. Is it any better on the futures? Well, no. New Zealand futures have seen another red week across the board. Whole milk powder, skim powder, AMF and butter have all crashed. Butter down 300 euros in euro terms. S&P down nearly 200 euros. And it's a similar picture, although not quite as bad, for the EU futures. Butter down 90 euros. On cheese, Gouda hasn't materially moved from its 3,100 euro level and only increases to 3,300 in quarter three. Same story for curd. And mild, it's still rubbish at around 3,600 euros, sterling, sorry, at best. And there are still plenty of stories of cheddar being sold off on the cheap still. Storage is a real issue for some firms. It's more expensive than ever. There's not a lot of it about, and it's very expensive. So much so, it's obviously cheaper to flog cheese cheap and get it out of store than it is to keep it in there. Meanwhile, AHDB has issued its AMPI and McV prices for March. AMPI is at 34.5 pence before costs and a processor margin. McV is at 39 pence, and there's still sizable costs to come off those figures. Both of them are at their lowest price since late 2021. Meanwhile, DEFRA's price for February has been put at 48.06 pence, which is around 46 pence on a standard 4% litre. That price seems very high in the context of current levels. Finally, spot price is around 32 pence delivered. So there you have it, another week of prices sliding down the snake with no end in sight. Now it's over to John and his tales from the Twilight Zone. But perhaps we'd better have a quick chat about milk price cuts first. Take it away, Ben.
Wowzers. I'm going to say, as you've just said there, actually, before we go on to the main discussion today about ukulele and sustainability with Hayley as well, we've got to talk about those prices. John, a penny for your thoughts.
Oh, 5 pence for his thoughts, actually. We'll have 5 pence for his thoughts, and that'll probably
even 5.1 pence.
So a sobering week, I suspect, especially for some, because obviously that's a big announcement by Arla, isn't it? Probably you would say, Chris, not unexpected in some regards. I don't know what.
I don't think it's unexpected at all. I think we've been flagging this up for, well, we've been flagging it up for 4 months. Mm. So has Stephen Bradley with his prices.
Yeah.
Make that pill any easier to swallow, though, does it?
No. And I think for a lot of the Arla members, then they will be, there'd be an element of shock today, especially when you think this, they, you know, now Arla have announced that price at the end of the month, so you know, if tomorrow in effect their milk price drops, doesn't it? So it's dropped significantly tomorrow for the milk that they're producing. I mean, taking your point, Ben, with your question, and I just want to chew it over with Chris here, that I think, you know, you'll say, well, what planet Zog were you on over in Brussels this week talking about a global shortage of dairy. Well, actually, we did address the short-term issues in the market, and they were covered. And this, what we're seeing here, is anticipated. Probably the trade is going too hard because there's an element maybe of payback that some people are talking about in the trade, and people saying, well, they got caught out on the rising market, so they're going to punish processors on the falling market. So if that is the case, they're a little bit silly.
Because that's definitely the case, John. There's definitely a revenge factor, I think.
Yeah,
but against that, you also have processors that are, you know, giving this stuff away.
Yeah, and partly for the reasons you said, mate. You know, and the dilemma is that now the price, and remember, Arla's price will still look good relative to some people who are going to be paying commodity-based prices. So commodity-based prices will be going into the low 30s, and that is not sustainable for a very long for a long time. So therefore, you know, what will happen is that there will be potentially a big market correction, because if you're going down into the low 30s and break-even milk prices are around 42, 43, as has been announced when you're talking about Tesco, that gap is so big that the milk flows will start to really come off a cliff probably in the second half of the year. And once you get past the spring, and once farmers get the cash flow effect in their bank account, I was talking to a farmer about this morning, is that in actual fact, what will happen is that the farmers won't feel it. Well, certainly they'll feel it next month when they get paid, or in the Arla case they will. But I mean, others will start to feel it when they get seasonality, they get the lower prices. And when they see those prices hitting their bank accounts, and then they're in the spring period with their cash flow, that is when you will get the effects. And we saw that on the rising market. Farmers didn't believe it was going to go up. And then when the prices hit the market, hit their bank accounts in July, August, they suddenly believed they were going to get better off. Now they won't believe they're going to get worse off until when they see the bank statements coming in June, July. So that will probably then result in quite a significant sort out in the market.
Yeah, I mean, in a falling market, however much longer is this going to go on for? How much further could we go?
If you look at the fundamentals that have driven this, then it is a very small increase in supply around the world. We estimate about 0.5% to 1%. And it's a small excess of demand, a demand drop of about 0.5% to 1%. So we're imbalanced by between 1% and 2% in the world. That's all we're talking about. And despite what you said about stocks, Chris, and we could talk about that, my understanding is there aren't massive stocks around the world. So this could correct itself very, very quickly once you find that people do react. And remember, we have got indications that demand is likely to be picking up now with these lower prices. So yep, that itself will contribute to it. So I think the traders have to be very careful. I would do it anyway if I can with positions on the market. I would fill my boots at present, because you're going to be buying below cost of production. And whenever you're doing that, you're always going to be on the right side. So, you know, in the marketplace at present, if I was a trader, get as much as you can at these prices, because it isn't going to stay there.
On the stock situation, John, we have to be mindful that the cheesemakers, with their limited storage that they have and can get hold of, they've got to free that space for the cheese that's going to come on with the flush. And there's going to be a lot more milk soon, a lot more cheese made. They need to store it and mature it. So if people aren't eating as much as they used to do and they can't get the storage, that's why it's coming out. I just hope that this year's flush isn't going to be a particularly big one. I don't know what you think the prospects of the flush are, John, but I hope it's not going to be a big one.
Well, I think it's just, and I did pick up some intelligence from UKLA talking to the trade over there. It is that actually, and remember, we need to see this correction in the market across the world. We're not just talking about the UK. UK probably, you know, is a bit unique because we do have a largely seasonal, big seasonal peak. But there is a normal seasonal peak as well across Europe. And they were saying that actually farmers will be, the Friesland Campina guys were saying that actually the Dutch farmers are going to be affected because the spring is turning into a bit of a late spring. And because of that, then they're having to feed the cows and buy in the expensive feed. Now, they've been happy to do that when they've had these very high milk prices. But when they get hit by what they were hit with this week by over 5.75 euro cent cut, then even they will get challenged. And therefore, with the late spring that they're encountering, and also they've got forage stocks that are very tight because they actually had a drought, if you remember, last year. So again, they were prepared to buy in the feed to make up for that forage. Whereas this time now, with the lower milk prices and the later spring in Europe, that could actually help the markets to sort themselves out as well.
Yeah, Ireland hasn't had a very good spring either, has it?
No. It's great, isn't it? I mean, we're all praying for a miserable spring. And Easter's coming up next week. I wanted to actually get out in the garden and enjoy myself. And here we are praying for a miserable spring. Hey-ho.
I thought you'd have a gardener, John, by now, old man like you. Can you still bend down?
Icky bugger.
I think the the question that we've got to ask, or the is how, where you're sort of 6 or 8 pence below cost of production, below break even milk price, is how long will it take to knock the edge off the production, or the demand obviously to increase to end up in a in a better place? And will people remain, how long can people afford to go below cost of production at that sort of level?
Well, I suspect, Becky, that actually one aspect that will come out is the variation between your milk buyers. And we've seen that. And that's what came out. This event will probably crystallise some of the change that we were talking about in Ukulele anyway, in terms of separating milk buyers out into those who actually pay for what the supply chain wants medium, long term, and those who buy on the commodities market. And when you've got commodities buyers or buyers in the UK who are orientated towards the commodities market, their suppliers will be seriously hit by this crisis. If you were Arla, yes, it all looks serious, but the fundamentals of that business are sound in the sense that they've got branded product, they've got other product into other supply chains, and they've got a limited amount into commodities. Same with Müller. So if you're in those supply chains, you will actually, in Müller, arguably, you'll go through this relatively in a far better place. But those fundamentals will mean that the people in the UK, and I guess in other places as well, who are exposed to commodity buyers in the future will be the people who will become the fall guys. And that, in a sense, will start to force some of the changes we were talking about in Nuclei this week.
Can I ask you a question, Chris? You bragged in your, not bragged, you commented in your milk market report that you and others had been predicting where we are now to quite a remarkable degree of accuracy. What, how good's the crystal ball looking going forward?
I'm still holding to mid-30s through to quarter three, because I think we should be able to maintain a three or four pence premium over the GDT and the futures, which are at 30, should be able to do that. And, on the basis that if it does crash into the 30s, it won't be there for long. That's where I would see things.
Right. We should probably talk about ukulele and sustainability as well, bring Hayley in, because that is largely what we wanted to do today, to actually reflect on that in the context of the long term. But because of what's been happening in the markets, I think that discussion was really, really important. So thank you, John and Chris as well, for doing that for us, because I think that was really valuable. But let's turn to ukulele. John, I gave listeners a bit of context about it in the intro. But can you tell us a little bit more about it? You've been there this week. What's been going on? What's it all about?
It's an annual event in every March or in spring. And basically, they take this forward view and of where the markets are going to be. Crazily, people will wonder what planet we were on, Chris. Then we were actually talking about the shortage of dairy in the world that is going to emerge. And So our listener will not believe that that's what we've been talking about this week.
Hmm. Yeah, I suppose it will have been a very different discussion to 12 months ago. So what was the general tone and content of the discussion?
Well, amazingly upbeat, in the sense that even those traders, Chris, I think came round to recognise the facts of the market, in the sense that in the short term, everybody can see that the market is going to be a very tough place in the world for the next 6 to 8 months. But we are probably on a turnaround. Now, we don't want the listener who, if they're making milk, to think, oh, that's crisis over, just hang on for 6 months. Because the reality of it is that they're in a very tough place. And we have to recognise that for a lot of dairy farmers at present, around the world, by the way, not just in the UK. But the medium long-term outlook, obviously, as we've been saying constantly, does remain very strong and very positive. And that's what we were talking about. And we did get the EU Commission there. And the EU Commission outlined what their plans were for their vision for the next 10 years. And that's something else. I mean, that really did take us to another planet in how the EU view things. But just to put this in context, right, just so we do understand and we commiserate with the listener so they understand what is going to happen. The markets currently are collapsing or have collapsed because milk supply around the world is up by 0.5% to 1%. And milk demand around the world is down by 0.5% to 1%. So we are not producing enormous volumes of milk in the world and flooding the world with milk. And the stock levels in the world are relatively tight, albeit cheesemakers in the UK will tell you that they've got surplus in the stores, unlike where they were only 18 months ago. So when you put all of that in context, that is why the markets are on the cusp of being able to be turned around in the short to medium term very, very quickly. And I don't know, you probably agree with that, Chris, would you?
Well, it's hard at the moment with some of the milk prices that have been announced to see the turnaround in the very, very short term. But counter to that, the big price cuts should, in theory, lead to milk drying up and then the rapid turnaround that you've been talking about. But no one that I know can really put a set timetable on that.
No. Mm-hmm. I think, actually, yeah, and this is why probably we do need to, yeah, people do need to take a step back and look at it. And we were looking more medium long term, so we'll come on to this now with Hayley being here with sustainability. And that is that actually, because the markets are going to go now so low, unfortunately, when they do recover, then it could mean that they go back very high again. And that volatility does do damage long term to markets, because it starts to damage capacity in the industry. So it's quite a big thing, actually. And we've been talking to the trade and the supply trade in the UK in recent weeks. We're talking like retailers and food service, and explaining to them, I think, what the initiative that Muller took in terms of really saying there's two sorts of markets. There's a market where you want sustainability, you want animal welfare, you want actually a security of supply, you want a supply through next winter. And then there's the commodity market. And the commodity market, yeah, you get cheap things, it's all price driven. So, but you can't guarantee security of supply. And so basically the Muller have been saying that, and we're not expecting to take less than cost of production at farm level for milk that you want when you want it secure and you want it to come with all those tick boxes that you are asking us to deliver on. And I think that's where, you know, Hayley, in terms of, you know, what she's been looking at, has been you've picked that up this week, haven't you, Hayley, in terms of the Dairy UK sessions that you were at?
Yeah, thanks, John. Yeah, I was on a farm visit earlier this week, that was hosted by the Dysons down in Wiltshire, which is a fantastic example of a dairy unit, and they're Arla suppliers. And it was a joint hosted event with NFU, AHDB, Dairy UK, and Arla as the kind of sponsor milk bar and chair of Dairy UK. And it was everybody getting together from the processing side of the industry, no retailers present, to actually have a kind of safe discussion about sustainability and the challenges that every processor, whether you're big or small, are facing in trying to get their heads around this and approach it. So it's a pre-competitive issue in many ways, sustainability. So it makes sense for processors to compare notes on you know, what you're doing as a business, how you're communicating this to retailers or other customers, how you're going about calculating emissions, engaging farmers, incentivizing farmers. So it was a really enthusiastic discussion. And I think a lot of the processors who were there, cheese manufacturers as well as liquid processors, you know, so big and small, to understand that they're not facing this alone. Because I think a lot of companies, they get pressured to or obliged to report on sustainability or to do something about it, and they're not quite sure where to start. So I think even hearing from some of the bigger players that this is something they've had to invest significant resources in. You know, it's not free to collect data. It's not cheap to gather emissions data for a business or for your farmer suppliers. But they all need support on it. And I think this is something that we'll see repeated again. So, you know, bringing together the processors and the different trade associations to share best practice, expertise. I think it was a really big step forward for the dairy industry in tackling what is, you know, a common challenge for everybody.
Okay. I mean, Hayley, a lot of the big picture elements of the sort of sustainability language, I suppose, we have covered on the show quite a bit in the past. But just for context, because I think it's important with what we're talking about, can you just run us through scope one, scope two, scope three, and what they mean?
Yeah, sure. So scope one and two emissions have been mandatory for listed UK companies and over a certain size as well to report on for a few years now. And so scope one and two emissions really are the emissions that you generate as a business through the activities that you do. And your scope two emissions are the electricity you use. So it's very straightforward. Scope three reporting was introduced a few years ago. Again, this isn't mandatory. There's a couple of small things as a listed company that you would be required to report on. But effectively, it's about calculating the emissions in the rest of your supply chain. So everything that you buy in. So obviously, if you look at a retailer, for example, what we're seeing as they start to map where the greenhouse gas emissions are in their overall portfolio, their actual scope one and two emissions, so that would be their headquarters, their stores, so you're talking about lighting, heating, as I say, fuel use, that kind of thing, it's actually tiny compared to the bulk of the emissions that sits in that downstream supply chain. And when I say the majority, you know, it's got up to 98% of their emissions sit in this part of the chain. And most of that is going to be agricultural and food products as well. So that's the sort of difference between the scopes. It all means emissions, but it's just about which box, which category of emissions that you're looking at.
Yeah, and I think it'd be interesting, actually. Sorry, John, you go.
Yeah, I was just coming in on this, Ben, because I wouldn't mind Hayley just explaining a little bit more, because the retailers in the UK and food service are driving this, you know, likes of Unilever, Mondelez, etc., Premier Foods, all of those want to understand these emissions. And Hayley and Ainsley were in a meeting recently, I know, and because the retailers have started to realise that probably they can't shift a reduction in scope three emissions in store by just moving to plant-based. I think they're seeing that, as we heard the other week, moving to plant-based is a lot harder than they probably envisaged. They're now coming back and down to the supply chain and in dairy and saying, look, you've really got to do something. You've got to make some big reductions. How are we going to do it? And they're very keen to do that, aren't they, Hayley? Because I think they're realizing the road's running out, that you can't just do it through plant-based.
Yeah, you're right, John. I mean, some of the retailers, when they started to map their emissions, thought, OK, how are we going to get these emissions down? Because although it's not a legal requirement to report all of your scope three emissions, this really fits into the sort of the public pressure that's been put on for companies to reach net zero by 2040 or 2050. So the science-based target initiative really exploded after COP26. And it's a partnership between various international bodies, which aims to drive significant, meaningful carbon reductions by private companies. And so every major company globally now is signing up to science-based targets. And to do that, you need to have mapped out all of your emissions. Because we know the bulk of emissions sit in that scope three, the big reduction target for a science-based target for a company is how to reduce your scope three emissions. Now, one way to reduce them is to simply cut them out. So as John said, if you purchase less meat and dairy and more plant-based, that comes with a lower carbon footprint. I say that in a kind of very very headline way. I don't think anyone's actually done full analysis and comparison of plant-based alternatives versus dairy, but let's take it as an assumption. But as John said, you know, trying to get consumers in a significant volumes to move away from dairy and supplement it with plant-based is I don't think is going to be a strategy that will work. So really then the focus has to be on how do we reduce emissions in a significant way of, you know, let's say meat and milk production in this context, because it's the sectors that we're closest to.
Yeah. Just taking that a step further, I suppose, to the other side of the chain, if we're talking about a shifting sands, I suppose, in terms of this direction, how does that relate to our listener, I suppose, to farmers?
This all comes down to farmers as well, and this is why farmers, I would say at least 40% of the industry now is doing a carbon footprint, and that is being driven by their milk processor, which in turn is being driven by the retailer. And the reason is that your emissions as a dairy farmer, so everything that you put into milk production, form the scope three emissions, the supply chain emissions of your milk processor. That in turn goes on to form the supply chain emissions and the scope three greenhouse gas emissions of the retailer. So really the farmer is the biggest source of emissions in the processor and the retailer's supply chain. So the attention is focused there. It's relatively easy for milk processors and retailers to sort out their scope one and two emissions because you switch to renewable energy, you use less fuel, you turn the lights off more. It's actually tackling the on-farm emissions. And that's why you're seeing with all the dedicated groups that there's much more focus now on sustainability. So we've looked at animal health and welfare, antibiotic use, that kind of thing. Now the attention is shifting to carbon reduction. From a farmer's perspective, though, I'd say that that's, you know, whether you buy into the kind of the bigger climate change piece, it's almost irrelevant because it's about efficiency. And so really the benefit for a farmer is thinking, right, if I reduce my carbon, you know, I increase my profit at the same time. So that is really the pitch at farm level.
Just going back to Ucolay, John, and I suppose my question is about the rate of change and the expectation of that rate of change. In discussions that you were having with people there on the sustainability sort of front, where's the appetite for the pace of change? What's your thoughts on that?
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, the UK is actually leading. Dairy UK has done a brilliant job in putting the UK at the forefront, and we are world leaders genuinely in terms of A, measurement, and B, starting to try and do things about it. And they were all all the processors are very, very interested in terms of what they can do to copy what is being done in the UK. So that's a great credit to farmers and the supply chain in the UK. So they're on the page. They also realise that there has to be a licence to operate, and that you've got to be able to deliver on these things along the supply chain in order to stay in business. The problem is, and this is what the nub of the debate at Ucolay, is that actually you can say scope three emissions, and Hayley would disagree a little bit, I think, and she might want to comment, but they can come free of cost because you can say, well, you know, you're making your business more efficient. That's all good practice. Hopefully that'll make you more money. So you're going to reduce your carbon emissions. Tick, tick, tick. That's great. But the reality is, on top of the costs of recording and capturing the data, you've also got compliance now coming down the line from legislation, which is what we heard about in the Netherlands. And those are where the costs are coming. And that is the costs coming into the supply chain for sustainability and not purely about scope three. They're largely about legislative costs, which we're having to deliver on and others around the world are delivering on. And we certainly saw that in Ucolay. In terms of, we've heard about the New Zealanders, they're in the page. The oh, the EU guys, well, you know, I mean, they really are running scared. When you heard the commission, and she was a lovely lady, Andrea, she did the presentation, and it was very nice. She was great economist. But, you know, the EU is actually planning to reduce the amount of dairy that is produced in the EU. And that means they want to reduce the amount that the EU produces to feed the world. That is their logic. And one of the things she said, which all the audience, we were all polite, we couldn't believe it, is that actually genetics and use of genetics at a farm level was not going to be a part of the future, because they expected yields per cow to drop, because they thought that we would go for less intensive systems, although that would make things more sustainable. The disconnect with EU policy and the reality on the world, sorry, it's scary. It really was scary to hear it. And she was a lovely person, don't get me wrong. But that's the way the EU is thinking at present.
She's only the messenger, though, John, really.
Oh, yeah, she was. There was nothing wrong with her. She was in, yeah, she did a very good job. And, she, you know, for the EU, that is where policymakers, whether or not it will actually work like that, is highly debatable, I would have to say, actually.
I can't see that policy working long term. Did the traders accept that they would have to pay for this sustainability or not?
Well, the traders do recognise, and they did take on board the points that we were discussing before we went, Chris, which is the fact that there is potentially a two-tier market. So there's a market for commodities where basically, will the product kill you? No. Okay, it's safe to trade, right? We can do that. Or is it a product which is going into a supply chain where people want all these quality assurance that we talked about earlier? And I think there was a recognition that that would be the case. And I think we flew the kite, forgive the pun, and we got the discussion going. And I don't think the answers are there yet, because somebody's got to pay. That's the reality. There has to be money coming out of the supply chain to pay for sustainability in this context that we're talking about. And I think everybody was struggling about how to get it. I think Muller in the UK and Arla can probably get that out of the supply chain for liquid. But I think when you come to a cheesemaker in Europe, getting the premium for sustainability out of the cheese market in Europe, when there's the effect of trade around with commodities, we're a long, long way away from that yet. But some of the traders did actually recognise, Chris, that perhaps it would have to come in as an international standard. So it would just become one of the things that you have to actually do. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
John, I think going back to your other point, I think there is a cost to scope three, because, you know, you've just said it, somebody has to pay. You know, data is expensive, but data is also incredibly useful. So at the moment, you've got processors investing money in carbon footprinting a significant number of dairy farms, and then engaging the farmers to understand, okay, what do I do with the data? How do I actually reduce carbon associated with my production? So that costs. And one of the things that came out of the Dairy UK led discussion and the HDB Day on Farm is that we've got to commercialise this in some way. You know, it has to go back, whether it'll be ultimately the consumer or the retailer as part of the premium for liquid milk. Cheese, I think, will be more of a challenge, but somebody has to pay. But the big bill that everybody seems to skip over is that the whole point of this is to reduce your emissions as much as possible once you've identified where they sit in your supply chain. And then ultimately you achieve net zero by removing the emissions that remain. That removal bill at the end is going to be significant. I mean, carbon markets are probably murkier than the trader market for milk that Chris introduced with. But who knows what the price of carbon will be by the time everyone wants to offset in 2040 or 2050. But that's what net zero is all about. So really, reducing carbon, you do have to invest to drive carbon down. You know, that's just a reality. It's probably ironic. This is one of the few scenarios that I can think of in the dairy sector where it isn't the farmer that has to pay. you know, the farmer will ultimately reduce carbon because everyone else is heavily investing into to reduce carbon on farm. The farmer makes more money by virtue of reducing carbon. And then when we get much further down the line, which isn't a conversation for today, when people are looking for carbon removals to offset their ultimate greenhouse gas balance sheet, well, it's farmers that are the people that are holding on to, you know, quite a good deal of carbon on farm. So this could come full circle. But for me, it's a win-win for farmers. But everyone else in the supply chain, you know, is going to have to pay at some point.
I think that's brilliant, Hayley. And actually, yeah, how they'll pay is actually potentially, well, in the short and medium term, and I think you've raised another point longer term, but it will probably make them pay, because what we did here is actually compound annual growth of demand for dairy for the last 10 years has been over 8% in export markets, over 8% per annum. That is serious. That is in terms of quantity of product that the export importers want to take, and also the price they're willing to pay. And so therefore, we're in a world where actually, yes, we've got a short-term issue now, but longer term, these markets will return because the world's going to sort it. Well, we hope it's going to sort itself out economically. So we revert back to that. And then you put onto it that on the supply side, the fact that in New Zealand, you can't create a new dairy farm. You can't get a permit for a dairy farm. So there can only be fewer dairy farms in New Zealand. They're all looking at valorization and adding value, not producing more milk. And then you come to the EU, the other big trading bloc, and they're telling us that we're all going to make less milk. And that was the key to the discussion, really, on the whole debate. And that was all about who is going to be the winner. Now, the US is certainly going to be the winner in the short to medium term, but they're probably going to end up having to come onto the scene in terms of doing more on sustainability as well. And then some of the players, Chris, they went off into the land of Zog, where they were starting to say, oh, well, it'll be Brazil. Oh, no, it could be Russia that could produce it. Oh, the Chinese and the Russians, and they could do a deal together. So the discussions we were having were quite, they did go a bit off piece. But the reality of trying to create supply chains in dairy in these places, which are politically unstable and difficult to produce milk in for other reasons other than just the environment, and creating dairy supply chains is not easy. So, if I was a dairy farmer at the conference and I'm coming back, medium long term, I'd say the market will find a solution for you, Hayley, because the market will just put up the price because there's just going to be less product available on the market for people wanting to consume more of it.
Well, I hope you're right, and I hope it does, because, you know, we focused a lot on scope 1, 2, 3 emissions and reducing them and paying for data. But there is another cost out there. I think you touched on it, John, and this is around the regulatory agenda. Now, if we just look at the UK, then I would say, you know, and Kite's been doing some work on this, that we're looking at a bill to UK dairying over the next 10 years of about $2 billion. For dairy farmers to comply with environmental regulations. And that's the Clean Air Act, so slurry store covers. We're looking at the silage slurry, agricultural fuel oil regulations, and the requirements, again, around slurry use and storage around that. Farming rules for water, trying to reduce diffuse pollution, water incidents from dairy farms and agriculture generally. All of these things are going to add up and cost a significant amount of money. So, again, you know, you've got where is the investment for that going to come from? Because currently farmers, I don't think, are in a position to make those investments. So whether that comes from the market, there will be some government support, but certainly not enough to cover the entire price tag. So, you know, we tend to sort of look purely down the lens of carbon and sometimes neglect the other environmental performance and sustainability indicators. And so I don't think we can take the eye off the ball on regulation, because it's arguably a bigger cost pressure to the industry than greenhouse gases.
Now you can see why we recruited Hayley to a job, can't you guys?
Can I ask a question?
We all need a Hayley. Go on, Chris. Brilliant.
Who's going to grow all the food that we need to eat? With all of this carbon and all the implications of this carbon coming down the line, where's all the food going to come from?
Well, and I think Hayley can come in on this, because I do think there's a feedback mechanism, and we did have somebody from the we started the session with an energy analyst about the decarbonisation of energy in the next 10 years. One of the things they raised is it's going to be a bumpy path. When you start to mess around with markets, chances are you'll create shortages. Chances are you'll create riots and political instability, as we see around the world now. And those are negative feedback loops that you have to start to think about. And climate change itself, Hayley, isn't it? That's I know topic you're looking at. That in itself starts to create crises as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to Chris's point, though, it's not about reducing or compromising food production. This is about producing food in the most environmentally sensitive and efficient way. And so carbon reduction is entirely feasible, Chris, when you focus on it, but it also makes UK production more efficient at the same time. The environmental regulation and the cost of compliance is a different one. Again, it's all about reducing environmental impact, but it does have a price tag. And I guess the question is, where will the industry find the money to pay for that cost of compliance? So one is sort of government implemented and led, and the other one is being led by the supply chain and the consumer. But, you know, it is a lot of pressure, but I don't think either of them are intended to compromise the UK production capacity for the dairy industry. Whether there will be an unintended consequence for some farmers, then, you know, that remains to be seen, I suppose.
Well, just picking up, and I realise, you know, time's precious, but, you know, if you replicate the bill for the UK, because there's similar schemes across Europe, it comes to over 20 billion euro in the next 10 years. I mean, these are serious sums of money.
Prices are going to go up.
Yeah, they are.
There is no alternative than food prices to go up. And consumers now are saying enough is enough. We can't afford food now. You know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't remember the number of stories there are around about food banks.
No.
You know, there has been an exponential growth in food banks.
That's a whole other podcast, isn't it?
Is that going to continue to go up? All of what we're talking about today is going to put food prices up, and that means a discontented public.
Mm. Yeah, and as Will says, that is another podcast, because I think that's the word that nobody denies that, but a lot of that is a big variation of people in society. There are people in society at present who are not suffering and can afford it, and there is a significant portion who is suffering. And that's a different podcast, as Will said, I think.
John, who will be the winners and losers, do you think, in the short and long term, in the context of everything we've been talking about today?
I think in the dairy supply chain, there'll be some people who might not like me for saying this, but that's what I'm paid to do sometimes, is to speak onto the truth. And I think it's going to be actually the professional forward looking operators in the dairy supply chain, whether they're at processor level or whether they're at farm level, wherever they are. And they've got to be quite businesslike. Yeah. And you've got to be willing to change and adaptive. And I think if you've got those characteristics, there is an amazingly bright future for those people in the dairy supply chain, for the fundamentals that Chris talked about, that you are going to be feeding the world. I think that if you're sticking the mud, you don't want to change, the world is, you don't want to be in control of it, you feel you're the victim of everything, go now, because it ain't going to get any easier.
Hmm. Okay. Loud and clear. Well, that's all we have time for today. But a very big thank you to our guests, John Allen, Hayley Campbell-Gibbons, and Chris Walkland.
Thank you very much for listening. Please see the show notes for more information, including our podcast disclaimer. We'll be back next week. But for now, it's goodbye from all of us here.